Chapter 3. Data Power to the People. Microsoft was born as a desktop computing software company. As it gained strength, it eventually dominated the PC industry, alongside Intel, the leading microprocessor supplier. But by the late 1980s, it became clear to Microsoft's leaders, in particular Bill Gates and David Vaskovich, that an excellent opportunity existed for growth in business computing. It could benefit data processing for accounting, marketing, HR, manufacturing, and more. At the time, only the larger businesses could afford expensive mainframes and mini computers, and had access to the most powerful and cutting-edge data processing and reporting capabilities. Medium-sized companies made do with networks of PCs and spreadsheets, and most small businesses did not own computers. Many technology companies contributed to democratizing business computing, but Microsoft delivered these new capabilities on a mass scale for all companies. Microsoft gave data power to the people. A lot of the credit for getting this started at Microsoft belongs to David Vaskovich. In 1971, while working at the University of Toronto, he designed and programmed one of the world's first email systems. Later, at the networking company 3Com, he helped Ethernet inventor Bob Metcalf establish the technology as the industry standard for running wired and wireless networks. In 1986, Microsoft's president at the time, John Shirley, lured David to Microsoft. David's first job, oddly, was to build up the company's marketing function. He had never managed marketing before. David worked on several strategic projects in his early years at Microsoft. In my view, the most important thing he did was whisper in Bill's ear about the potential for building a large software business, serving the enterprise market. Doing so meant supplying an array of run-the-business software products and services. At first, Bill rejected the idea. As David recalls, Bill told him the company lacked the expertise to build large-scale software systems. But David did not give up on enterprise computing. He wrote a detailed business plan and began hiring technology and business experts who understood the enterprise market. He realized that to succeed, Microsoft needed its own highly scalable relational database. Finally, Bill gave him the go-ahead to build a database team. And in parallel, Bill launched the effort to develop Windows NT. Meanwhile, to get a foothold, David and Bill engineered the connection with Sybase and Ashton Tate to jointly resell Sybase's database, as described in Chapter 1. A pivotal moment for David and Microsoft's enterprise ambitions came in 1993, when David had the nerve to attend the annual international workshop on high-performance transactional processing. This invitation-only affair occurred yearly at Asilomar, a stunningly beautiful conference center on the California coast. Event attendance was the computing industry counterpart of being invited to the Vatican, where only the most accomplished computer scientists were welcome. David met and courted people from DEC, IBM, Oracle, and other business computing giants there. Afterward, he hired 10 of them. The new team members became the intellectual foundation for Microsoft's foray into enterprise database computing. One of those hires was Peter Spiro. Peter is a bearded computer scientist with a powerful New Hampshire accent. He spent the previous decade as a database architect for DEC, where he helped engineer RDB to be the fastest database in the world. At the time, DEC planned on selling its software business. Peter did not like the idea of working for any of the likely inquirers, so he started looking for a more amenable situation. That turned out to be Microsoft and the Enterprise Initiative. "I was hired by Microsoft to be a change agent," Peter recalls. When Peter arrived in Redmond, only 6 engineers worked on SQL Server, led by Ron Sukup. SQL Server was one of several separate database engineering projects underway within Microsoft, each vying for the company's future enterprise database product. The SQL Server team collaborated with Sybase engineers to improve the database. David and Bill had already decided that Microsoft needed to develop its version independently on the foundation provided by Sybase's codebase. While Sukup and his small engineering team did excellent work compared to the hundreds of engineers at Oracle and other database companies, Microsoft needed to grow the team and completely change the architecture and code to compete. Peter started as one of two vital engineering leads. As the organization grew, it divided into two teams. The relational engine team, led by Hal Berenson, with Getz Grafe as the technical lead, and the storage engine team, led by Peter, with David Campbell as the technical lead. Eventually, Peter became the leader of the entire project. Peter did not race into this. From the beginning, he wanted to create a sustainable engineering culture that could last for decades. At the time, software programmers in the PC industry were often young and inexperienced, and they typically darted from one project to another, and sometimes between companies. Peter recruited seasoned programmers and kept them happy and productive for years, or even decades. Some of the engineers Peter hired in the mid-1990s are still on the SQL Server development team today. Peter aimed to replicate at Microsoft the engineering culture that thrived at DEC. Peter's engineering culture centered on the core value that each team member saw themselves as a professional, committed to quality. That meant they would produce code with as few errors as possible. And when they found problems, they would fix them immediately. They would fail fast and fix fast. There was no expectation that engineers on the SQL Server team would work from 60 to 80 hours a week, which was typical in the industry then. 50 to 55 hours was plenty. Peter did not want people to be exhausted, and therefore prone to making mistakes. It was all about quality. At the time, tech journalists thought that Microsoft's first release of a new product would be horrible, and the second major upgrade would be okay. The third version, however, would be a killer that worked smoothly and contained the features most customers wanted. Peter pledged that the first Microsoft version of SQL Server would be the killer, and the engineering team delivered on that promise. Back then, Microsoft software products typically shipped with software bugs that customers reported, and the Microsoft engineers fixed them. Each team would put out a new version of the product a year or so after the original release with bug fixes. When SQL Server 7.0 launched in 1999, it was the first pure Microsoft product, and there was no need for version 7.5. I wrote earlier about the importance of installing fundamental values in an organization, and want to elaborate on how we implemented that in Microsoft's culture. Paul Flessner was Peter's counterpart on the business side. He was a CIO for a Fortune 100 company that did serious transaction processing with mini computers and mainframes. He joined Microsoft a few months after Peter did. At the time, Paul Moritz, one of Microsoft's top executives, spent a lot of time talking to corporate customers. He visited Paul Flessner's company and pitched the capabilities of Microsoft's brand new Windows NT operating system for servers. Paul Flessner recalls being so impressed with Microsoft's vision that he followed Paul Moritz into the parking lot and told him he wanted to work there. A recruiter from Microsoft called him the following week. Paul started as a program manager on the SQL Server team. His job was talking to enterprise customers to find out what they wanted in the product. When the project's general manager became ill, Paul was offered the GM job on a probationary basis. He said he would only do it if the job was his. The bosses said yes. He held that job for the next 10 years, managing the business to its first $100 million in sales, then $500 million, then $1 billion, and beyond. But before sales charts had a growth curve looking like a hockey stick, Microsoft needed a product. That was Peter's job. An enterprise-scale database has two major components. First, it needs a storage engine, which governs how the system accesses the records on a disk. The other part is the relational engine, which understands the SQL query and translates it into instructions that the storage engine can execute. There was much technical experimentation in the 1970s and 80s. When Peter and the team worked on SQL Server, we embraced the best techniques for designing and building enterprise relational database products. The time was ripe for modernization. Microsoft would reinvent SQL Server using proven architectures and approaches, and adding features that met the moment's needs. For example, sophisticated applications required a feature called record locking, and it posed considerable engineering challenges. Meanwhile, Microsoft's well-established competitors grappled with ill-fitting legacy technologies from the past. When the company released Microsoft SQL Server 7.0, nearly all of the relational engine's code and about 80% of the storage engine code were new. Microsoft's database was less expensive and easier to use than those of Oracle, IBM, and the other dominant players. A traditional database requires a large amount of fine-tuning by a corporate customer's database administrators. Those administrators had to configure dozens or even hundreds of settings correctly to get the database to perform well. With SQL Server 7.0, it worked right out of the box and self-optimized as it processed data. Also, SQL Server 7.0 required less maintenance, lowering the total cost of ownership, a term that Microsoft popularized. Paul's comment: "We changed the economics of enterprise computing." Paul recalls that his mom wanted to understand the product he worked so hard on in the early days. She asked if a database is something people would like to receive as a gift. I told her no, Paul says. But looking back, it really was a gift. Our customers wanted to reduce capital and operational costs, and this did that for them. Peter, Paul, and their teams produced versions of SQL Server for different-sized companies. They gave the database away for free to software developers. They also built a desktop version. That move is a no-brainer now, but it was controversial then. Some engineers considered desktop computers toys and did not believe an enterprise-scale database could run on them. But through innovative engineering, the team got it done. This effort produced a family of products that served a vast market. We were running everything from bingo applications on a desktop to nuclear power plants and train systems in Japan, Paul says. One of the top factors in the rocket launch success of SQL Server 7.0 was the work that Paul and others did to create an ecosystem of technology partners. Microsoft had successfully run this play with MS-DOS and then with Windows. It was the most important tech ecosystem on the planet. Microsoft's program managers copied and applied the Windows platform / partnership model to other products. Encouraged by the success of Windows, hundreds of software application companies jumped on the Windows NT bandwagon, and a great mix of application vendors, systems integrators, and value-added resellers did the same with SQL Server 7.0. Paul's most formidable and strategic partner was SAP, the dominant player in run-the-business software applications for enterprises. SAP's CEO back then was Hasso Plattner, a brashly confident German who initially did not have much regard for Microsoft's enterprise database. Later, he changed his mind. Oracle made aggressive moves in the enterprise application business, and Hasso wanted to hobble Oracle any way he could. SAP ported its applications to SQL Server 7.0. I don't believe SAP at first really believed in our database, but they wanted some leverage against Oracle, so they went with it, Paul says. David Vaskovich tells the backstory. One day he got a call from Hasso, who was in Seattle, and had his teenage daughter with him. Hasso wanted to talk face to face. The two men sent Hasso's daughter and David's teenage son off to explore a science museum. And then Hasso and David spent 3 hours walking the streets together, hashing out the framework of a deal. In that agreement, SAP would release its R3 application suite on SQL Server within 90 days after Microsoft shipped a database version with record locking as a feature. No money would change hands, but each company would assign 16 top engineers to work on the porting project in the other's offices. The deal worked and paid off for both companies. Paul and Peter remained close friends. Both eventually left Microsoft, but they sometimes invest together in startups, mostly in the social entrepreneurship space. They have advice for people who want to transform industries. It's three things, and you need all three, says Paul. First, you need a great team. If you have a great team, you have a chance to build a great product. And if you have a great team and product, you have a chance to build a great business. Peter agrees, but says company culture must support the three elements. Your culture drives virtually everything you do in engineering, he says. Do you care about hiring great people? Do you care about performance and quality? Do you care about customers? Do you provide great management and leadership? This list goes on and on. We very consciously thought about all this stuff, and more. When I look back on this era, I am struck by what David, Peter, Paul, and a host of other people at Microsoft accomplished. They disrupted an industry and made the power of data available to everybody. They could do it because Microsoft's desktop products were so successful and profitable, which enabled the company to invest a lot of money and time in developing its enterprise products. Bill gave them plenty of slack. In the early days, he left the engineering teams alone. And later, though he did a lot of reviews, he did not rush the process. I am often reminded of the early days of Microsoft SQL Server because I built a data center on my property outside Seattle to test new products. That was in 2004. I ran the Windows Server division then and wanted to understand in detail how our products worked. So I had our building contractor install a raised floor data center in a room complete with all the usual data center bells and whistles. At one point, I had 11 servers on 5 racks, running all Microsoft's server products, SQL Server, Exchange, System Center, and SharePoint. It was a crazy thing to do, but I gained firsthand experience with the products my teams built, and thus I could provide better direction. If having a data center in my home seemed outlandish in 2004, it is nuts today, because everything has moved to the cloud. All my servers are gone now, but the data center remains. It is a white elephant from a different time.